Macmillan Audio presents The Warsaw Protocol by Steve Barry. Read for you by Scott Brick. Prologue. Monday, August 9th, 1982. Warsaw, Poland. 3:45 p.m. Janusz Czajkowski wanted to look away from the gruesome scene before him, but he knew that would be worse. He'd been brought here to Mokotów prison for the express purpose of watching. This place had a long and storied history. The Russians built it in the early 20th century. The Nazis used it extensively, as did the communists after the war. Since 1945, this was where the Polish political underground, the intelligentsia, and anyone else considered a threat to the Soviet-controlled government was held, tortured, and executed. Its heyday had come during Stalin's time, when thousands had been held at Rakowiecka Street prison, which was how most Poles referred to it then. Sometimes, though, they spat out the German label, Nacht und Nebel, night and fog, a place of no return. Many were murdered in the basement boiler room. Officially, such atrocities had ended with Stalin. But that was not actually the case. Dissidents for decades after had continued to be rounded up and brought here for interrogation. Like the man before him. Middle-aged, naked, his body bent over a tall stool, his wrists and ankles tied to the blood-stained wooden legs. A guard stood over him with legs spread across the prisoner's head, beating the man on his back and bare ass. Incredibly, the prisoner did not make a sound. The guard stopped the assault and slipped off the bound man, planting the sole of his boot into the side of the man's head. Spittle and blood spewed out. But still, not a sound.
"It's easy to manufacture fear," the tall man standing next to Janusz said. "But it's even easier to fake it."
The tall man wore the dour uniform of a major in the Polish army. The hair was razor-cut in military style, a black mustache tight and manicured. He was older, of medium build, but muscular, with the arrogant, entitled personality he'd seen all too often in the red bourgeoisie. The eyes were dark points, diamond-shaped, signaling nothing. Eyes like that would always hide much more than they would reveal, and he wondered how difficult maintaining such a lie must be. A name tag read Dilecki. He knew nothing about this major, other than having been arrested by him.
"To manufacture fear," Dilecki said, "you have to mobilize a large portion of the people to accept it exists. That takes work. You have to create situations people can see and feel. Blood must be shed. Terrorism, if you will. But to counterfeit fear? That's much easier. All you have to do is silence those who call fear into question. Like this poor soul."
The guard resumed beating the naked man with what looked like a riding crop, a metal bearing hanging from its tip. Welts had formed, which were now bleeding. Three more guards joined the assault, each delivering more blows.
"If you notice," Dilecki said, "they are careful. Just enough force to inflict pain and agony, but not enough to kill. We do not want this man to die. Quite the contrary. We want this man to talk."
The prisoner clearly was suffering, but he seemed unwilling to allow his captors the satisfaction of knowing that fact.
"You've forgotten the kidneys," Dilecki called out.
One of the guards nodded and began to concentrate his blows to that area of the body.
"Those organs are particularly fragile," Dilecki noted. "With just the right blow, there's no need to even bind or gag people. They cannot move or utter a sound. It's excruciating."
Not a hint of emotion laced the shrill voice, and he wondered what it took for someone to become so inhuman. Dilecki was a Pole. The guards were Poles. The man being tortured was a Pole. Madness. The whole country was being held together by force and propaganda. Solidarity had risen from nothing and tried to eliminate the Soviets. But 8 months ago, Moscow finally had enough of concessions and ordered a crackdown. Overnight, tens of thousands had been jailed without charges. Many more were seized, then bussed out of the country. People simply vanished. All pro-democracy movements were banned, their leaders, including the famed Lech Wałęsa, jailed. The military takeover had been quick and coordinated. Soldiers now patrolled the streets of every major city. A curfew had been imposed, the national borders sealed, airports closed, road access to main cities restricted. Telephone lines were either disconnected or tapped, mail subjected to censorship, and classes in schools and universities suspended. Some had even died. No one knew the exact count. A 6-day work week had been ordered. The media, public services, healthcare, utilities, coal mines, ports, railroads, and most key factories were placed under military management. Part of the crackdown involved a process that examined everyone's attitude toward the regime. A new loyalty test included a document that pledged the signer would cease all activity the government even thought might be a threat, which was how many had been netted, including himself. Apparently, his answers had not been satisfactory, though he'd lied as best he could. The beating stopped for a moment. He forced his brain into action and asked, "Who is he?" "A professor of mathematics. He was arrested leaving a solidarity meeting. That makes him, by definition, not innocent."
"Does he know anything?"
"That is the thing about interrogation," Dilecki said. "Many times it is merely a search for useful information. So what he knows remains to be seen." A pause hung in the air. "Interrogation also has other purposes. It can frighten those not being tortured, allowing us to break down their resistance and rebuild them in more pliable ways." Now he understood why he was here. Dilecki's eyes narrowed as his gaze focused. "You hate me, don't you?"
"No sense lying."
"Absolutely." "I don't care. But I do want you to fear me." His legs began to tremble. Dilecki turned his attention back to the prisoner and motioned. One of the guards kicked the stool over, tumbling the beaten man hard to the concrete floor. The wrists and ankles were untied, and the man's bleeding body folded in pain. Still, though, he'd neither cried out nor said a word, which was impressive. More so, in fact, than Dilecki's counterfeit fear. So he drew off that courage and asked,
"What do you want with me?"
"I want you to keep your eyes and ears open and tell me what you see, what you hear. I want you to report all that you know. I want to know about our friends and our enemies. We are facing a great crisis and need the help of people like you."
"I'm nobody."
"Which makes you the perfect spy." Dilecki laughed. "But who knows? One day you might be a big somebody." He'd heard what the instigators and supporters of martial law liked to say. Poland was surrounded by the USSR, East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Ukraine, and Belarus, all Soviet-controlled. Martial law had been implemented to rescue Poland from a possible military intervention by those Warsaw Pact countries. Like what happened in Hungary in 1956 and Czechoslovakia in 1968 when the Soviets crushed all opposition. But no one seriously believed such nonsense. This was about those in power keeping power. Communism's entire existence depended on coercion. Polish communism seemed an odd mixture of socialism and fascism, where a small group controlled everyone else, along with all of the resources, while the vast majority lived in hunger and poverty. The prisoner on the floor stirred. His frail body twisted as if gripped by a terrible arthritis. One of the guards kicked him in the midsection. Vomit erupted from the man's mouth. One part of Janusz desperately wanted to help the man. The other just wanted to flee, doing, saying whatever was necessary to make that happen. Dilecki,
like an exacting schoolmaster, was challenging every conclusion, every statement, keeping him in confusion. With no choice, he said what was expected.
All right, I'll do as you ask.
Deletsky stood, hands lightly clasped, the shrewd eyes steady.
I want you to remember that if you lie to me, or try to trick me, or hide from me, you will end up tied to a stool, too.
The thin lips curled into the faintest of smiles.
But enough threats. You have done right, comrade. As the song proclaims, Poland has not yet perished, so long as we still live.
And what the foreign force has taken from us, we shall, with saber, retrieve.
The words came from the prisoner on the floor, lying amid his own vomit, beaten, bleeding, making no attempt to conceal the triumph in his voice as the second line of the national anthem was repeated. Sacred words to every Pole, and one's Janusz would not forget.
Present Day. Chapter 1, Tuesday, June 4th, Bruges, Belgium. Cotton Malone hated when 2 plus 2 equaled 5. Over the course of his former career as an American intelligence officer, that troubling result had happened far more often than not. Call it an occupational hazard or merely just plain bad luck. No matter. Nothing good ever came from fuzzy math. Like now. He was standing inside what the Belgians called Heilig Blut Basilik, the Basilica of the Holy Blood, a foreboding 12th century edifice, home to one of Europe's most sacred reliquaries. The ancient church was tucked into a corner of the castle square, squished between the old city hall and a row of modern shops. He'd traveled to Bruges for the largest antiquarian book fair in Europe, one he'd attended several times before. In fact, it was a favorite, not only because he loved the city, but also thanks to the best dessert in the world. Dame Blanche, White Lady. Vanilla ice cream, drenched in warm Belgian chocolate, topped with whipped cream. Back in America, they called them sundaes. Fairly ordinary. Not here. The locals had elevated the treat into an art form.
Each cafe possessed its own version,
and he'd definitely be enjoying another incarnation after dinner tonight. Right now, he'd come to see a spectacle, one he'd never witnessed before but had heard about. It used to happen only once a week. Now it was every day, either mornings between 11:30 and noon or 2 o'clock and 4 o'clock in the afternoon, according to the placard out front. It even had a title. The Veneration of the Precious Blood. Legend said that after the crucifixion, Joseph of Arimathea was granted Christ's body. With solemn devotion, he cleaned the corpse, catching all the blood flowing from the wounds into a sacred vessel, which he supposedly passed down to his descendants. Depending on which version was to be believed, drops of that blood made their way to Bruges either in the 12th century by way of Jerusalem, or in the 13th century through Constantinople. Nobody knows which tale was true. But here that blood had stayed, occasionally hidden away from Calvinists, revolutionaries, and invaders. Pilgrims had come for centuries to see it, encouraged by a papal bull from the 14th century that granted indulgences to all who prayed before the relic. The whole thing ranked as beyond strange, given that the Bible mentioned nothing about any of Christ's blood ever being preserved. Yet that had not deterred the faithful. The basilica consisted of two chapels, the lower dark and Romanesque, and the upper bright and Gothic. Twice destroyed, each time rebuilt. He glanced around at the upper chapel. The soaring ceilings of three richly embellished naves drove the eyes heavenward. Impressive stained glass windows allowed golden rays of afternoon sunlight to seep inside. An elegant ceiling, like an upturned boat, stretched overhead, all in stunning polychrome woodwork. A bronzed pulpit hung high on one wall, shaped like a globe. A gold-laden altar stood before a series of ascending murals, rich in color that, appropriately, depicted Christ shedding blood. Tourists filled the rows of wooden chairs before the communion rail, and even more loitered about snapping pictures.
But back to that weird math of 2 plus 2 equaling 5, starting with 3 men. Different from the other visitors, young, cautious, unshaven for a few days, with plain even features. Their faces also wore a different expression from those surrounding them, as if they had a more urgent reason to be here than mere sightseeing. Their alertness bothered Cotton, projecting a tension that said these were not tourists. A final red flag came from their positions, strategically around the chapel, near the exterior walls, their focus more on one another than the reverent surroundings. He glanced at his watch. 2:00 p.m. A bell sounded. Showtime. In the side nave, beyond the arches, a door opened and a priest emerged. The veneration had begun. A robed prelate carried a rectangular-shaped glass-sided box. Inside, atop a red velvet pillow, lay the reliquary. The phial itself, which harbored pieces of sheep's wool clotted with blood, was about 6 inches long and 2 inches wide. Mainly rock crystal of a clear Byzantine origin, the neck was wound with golden thread, the end stoppers sealed with wax. It lay inside a larger glass cylinder with golden coronets ornamented by angels. He'd read enough about the outer cylinder to know that engraved on the frame was a date in Roman numerals, May 3rd, 1388. The priest paraded across the chapel, his face an expression of great piety, to what was known as the throne of the relic, a white marble Baroque altar, its top covered by more red velvet. The prelate gently laid the glass-lined box atop the platform, then sat in a chair, ready for the faithful to pray before the relic. But not before they each made a donation. A line formed to the left where another priest stood before a collection bowl. People dropped euros into it before stepping up the short stairs and spending a few moments in silence with the relic. Cotton wondered what would happen if someone failed to drop a coin but still wanted to venerate. Would they be turned away? The three amigos had shifted position and, along with everyone else, moved from the main nave toward the side chapel. Several attendants shepherded the crowd and shushed any voices that rose too loud. Pictures, pointing, videos, gawking, and donating were allowed. Talking, not so much. One of the amigos worked his way into the veneration line. The other two stayed back near the archways, watching the spectacle from 20 feet away. A bank of devotional candles separated the throne of the relic from the crowd, a couple hundred little glass sockets, many of them flickering with flames. Several of the visitors approached and lit a candle of their own, after, of course, dropping a coin into a metal container. People continued to step up to the reliquary, pausing a few moments for prayer and a sign of the cross. The pair of amigos who'd stayed back both toted knapsacks, though many of the others present also carried them. Something about these two shouldering them didn't seem right. 12 years he'd worked for the Justice Department at the Magellan Billet, after a career in the Navy and time as a JAG lawyer. Now he was retired, opting out early, the owner of a rare bookshop in Copenhagen, occasionally available for hire by governments and intelligence agencies. He made a good side living from freelancing, but today was no job, just sightseeing. Apparently in the right place at the wrong time. Something was happening. Something that every instinct in his nearly 50-year-old body told him was not good. Old habits were truly hard to break. The amigo in line approached the collection bowl, dropped in a coin, then climbed the short steps to the marble table where the stoic priest remained on guard. The two other amigos slipped off their backpacks and unzipped them. The clangor of alarm bells inside Cotton's head took on a shriller tone. He could hear the robot from Lost in Space, the old sci-fi show. "Danger, Will Robinson." One amigo removed a gun. The other held what appeared to be a metal cylinder. He pulled the pin and tossed the canister into the side chapel. A grenade? Smoke immediately billowed out. No. A diversion. Cotton's thoughts were shattered by the sharp report of the gun being fired twice into the ceiling. Plaster and wood splinters showered down. A wave of panic spread fast. A woman shrieked. Voices were raised. More screaming. People moved in a herd toward the only exit. a richly decorated circular staircase that led down, maybe 100 all rushing out, creating pandemonium. Another shot rang out. A thick cloud of gray smoke billowed into the main nave, obstructing the view into the side chapel and reliquary. Cotton pushed through the crowd and headed for the smoke. Through the growing haze, he saw the amigo who'd been in line shoving the priest aside. Another wave of excited visitors formed a wall between where he stood and the three amigos, who were moving farther against the grain of the exodus. He pushed his way forward, the two other amigos angling toward the third, who shattered the glass case holding the reliquary. The priest lunged, trying to stop the theft, but one of the amigos planted a fist in the older man's face, sending him down. What was this? A classic flash-and-bang robbery? Sure looked like it. And it was working. Big time. The three amigos moved toward the side door from which the priest had first entered, which surely led into the back bowels of the basilica. Probably another way down, too, which meant these guys had done their homework. Cotton cleared past the last of the frantic tourists and stepped into the side chapel. He was having trouble breathing, coughing out smoke, his eyes watering. The priest was a concern, so he made his way to the altar and found the older man lying on the floor. "You okay?" he asked. The guy was groggy, his right eye red and swollen, but the priest grabbed Cotton's right arm in a tight clamp.
"Need to get it back."
The three amigos were gone. Surely the police were on the way. Somebody had to have alerted them, but they'd be little help in finding the thieves, who were about to dissolve into the busy streets of Bruges. He galvanized himself into action. Sightseeing over. "I'll get it back." Chapter 2. Slovakia. Jaunty Olivier hated the intimidation aspect of his business. He considered himself a refined gentleman, a man of distinguished taste, a connoisseur of aged wine and good food, a learned man whose studies of the classics dominated his spare time. Even his name conjured up movie royalty, Olivier, as in Sir Laurence Olivier. Above all, he was a consummate professional. His specialty? Information. His reputation? One of a man who could provide exactly what someone needed to know. Interested in the hidden net worth of a potential business partner or a possible buyer? No problem. How many automatic rifles and how much ammunition had the Boko Haram imported into Nigeria last month? Easy. What will the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia press for at the coming bilateral talks? A bit more difficult, but doable. What were the Hezbollah Mujahideen up to in Kashmir? Or how will the EU foreign exchange markets value the euro at the close of business today? Both tricky, but the answers would be close enough. Besides, he gave a discount if he wasn't 100% sure, since, by and large, partial information was far better than none at all. His motto? Scientia potentia est. Sir Francis Bacon had been right. Knowledge is power. But its acquisition came with challenges. Greed remained a universal motivator, so money usually worked. Bartering also brought results. He didn't even mind a hard bargain, as that was the nature of the game. But spies, those he detested. The arms and legs of the man sitting before him were taped to a metal chair. A wire snaked into the mouth and down the esophagus, its gauge carefully chosen, fine enough not to trigger any gagging reflex, but thick enough to do the job. At its end hung a metallic, conductive beak, while the other end connected to a DC transformer. Amateurs would have worked on the exterior, prying, twisting, beating, or kicking the information out. He preferred a more refined approach. This technique administered a much deeper and more painful discomfort, and came with the added benefit of not leaving a mark. He pointed. "Who sent you?" No reply. He glanced at his associate. Vic DiGenti had worked with him a long time. Their paths had first crossed in his former line of work, where he'd learned that Vic could handle almost anything. And thank goodness. Everyone needed a sidekick. Laurel had Hardy. Martin, Lewis. He had Vic. A thin, gnarly man with straight black hair and narrow gray eyes. A person of few words, but with great discretion and absolute loyalty, all with a total lack of greed. He motioned, and Vic twisted the transformer control. The eyes of the man bound to the chair went wide as electricity surged through the thin line and down his throat. The body convulsed against the straps. Not a sound was made, as one of the side effects of this particular method of persuasion was an inability to scream. Vic knew when to stop, and after 5 seconds, he switched off the current. The convulsions ended. Spittle drooled from both corners of the man's mouth. A bit disgusting, but expected. "Do you require another demonstration?" he asked. "I can certainly provide it, but I beg you, please don't make that necessary." The man's head shook from side to side, his breathing hard and labored. The whitewashed walls around him smelled of damp and rot, and he wanted to be gone. "I'm going to ask my question again. It's vitally important that you answer. Is that clear?" The man nodded. "Who do you work for?" More silence. He let out a long exhale of exasperation. Vic sent another 5 seconds of electricity through the man's body. They had to be careful since DC current, if not delivered correctly, killed. This spy had been caught yesterday in Bratislava. He and Vic had been there, ironing out a few last-minute details. They'd both noticed the attention, then used reflections off cars and an occasional glance to identify the pursuer. They then joined a throng of window shoppers and confirmed that they had a tail. Vic, being ever vigilant, managed to snag the problem without drawing attention. "Surely you must see that you're on your own here," Chanti pointed out. "No one is coming to save you. Do I have to give you another demonstration?"
"I was there to check on you, to find out what I could."
The words came out choked from the wire down his throat, and with an Eastern European accent to the English. "That's obvious. What did you discover?"
"Nothing at all."
He doubted that. "Did you report your finding of nothing?"
"Not yet."
"All lies, surely. Who do you report to?" No answer. This one was stubborn. He motioned, and Vic again turned the knob. The body pulsated hard against the restraints, bucking and stiffening. He allowed the agony to linger a few seconds longer this time, but not enough to paralyze the heart. He nodded, and Vic killed the current. The man went limp in the chair, unconscious. Vic brought him around with 2 hard slaps to the face. So much was about to happen. 7 invitations had been extended. Nearly all the invitees had shown interest. Only 3 RSVPs were outstanding, and the deadline loomed at midnight tomorrow, a little over 24 hours away. "I don't like spies," he said to the man. "They obtain information, then simply give it to their employers. They are my chief competition. Thankfully, you're not a good spy. I've asked 3 times. If you force me to ask who you work for again, I will leave the current on until you are dead." He allowed his bluff to take hold. One rule he always adhered to, though never advertised, was that he killed no one. But he would make this man wish he were dead. The coming operation was the most complicated he'd ever undertaken. 2 in one, actually. Both intricate, with lots of moving parts, the one dependent on the other. But the rewards. Oh, the rewards. The one deal could yield 20 million euros or more. The other? Hard to know for sure, but it could approach 100 million euros, enough that he could do whatever he wanted for the rest of his life. But everything could be in jeopardy, thanks to this spy. His eyes met Vic's.
No, please, don't,
the man begged. His gaze shifted back to the spy. Answer my question.
Reinhardt sent me.
The name sent a shiver down his spine. His nemesis. The last person he expected to be watching. His gaze caught Vic's. And the knob was turned again. Chapter 3 Cotton fled the smoky chapel through the side door and entered a small anteroom. Ecclesiastical robes hung on a rack, which meant this was where the priests dressed before Mass. He'd been an altar boy himself until age 13, when all of his questions surfaced. Catholicism was really good at explaining what, but not so much on why. Teenagers were full of questions, and when the answers never came, he decided that being Catholic was not for him, so he drifted away. Now, when asked about religion, he always said he was born Catholic, but not much of a practitioner. Maybe that explained why he'd jumped into the middle of this mess. Did he owe the church one? Not necessarily, but he jumped in anyway. He fled the anteroom into a short hall that ended at another staircase down. This one was nothing like the elaborate main entrance that the crowd had poured toward when the commotion started. Just narrow wooden risers here. He pounded down, found a door that opened outside, and squinted in the afternoon sunlight. A sea of people filled the square that stretched out before the old city hall. Scared tourists from the upper chapel clung together in a nervous knot. His eyes raked the crowd, searching for signs of the three amigos. He spotted them at the far end of the cobbles, about to turn a corner and disappear. The reliquary was not in sight, most likely inside one of the backpacks. Bruges was a Gothic gem, its egg-shaped historic center light on cars, heavy on people and bicycles. A ring road kept traffic away, but a series of canals crisscrossed the city and gave the place its nickname, Venice of the North. It was Belgium's number one tourist attraction, with a broad tangle of crooked streets lined with colorful guildhouses. The old marketplace once hosted trade fairs, medieval jousts, even executions. Many of the multi-story polychrome facades remained. Block after block, in fact, formed a living museum that had earned the distinction of a World Heritage Site designation. His record with those was not good. Not that he intentionally tried to wreak havoc. But crap just happened. He took off after the amigos and turned the same corner. They were nearly 100 yards ahead, moving between two more rows of gabled houses. Believing they'd escaped, they seemed less panicky, more casual. He decided to close the gap and started to run. There weren't many people on this side street, because it led away from the main attractions, toward the outer ring road. He managed to close the distance to 50 yards. One of the amigos caught sight of his pursuit. The guy grabbed the other two and let them know their escape had been noticed. They broke into a run. Great. He bounded forward. The street ended at one of the arched bridges, which meant there was a canal coming up. The amigos made it to the other side and vanished to the right. Cotton bolted into a faster pace and saw that they'd descended a set of stone steps to a quay where a boat waited. The three thieves hopped in and sped off, passing under the bridge beneath him and disappearing out the other side. Two of the amigos tossed him a casual wave. On his side of the canal, he spotted one of the many open-topped boats with 20 empty seats, waiting for another group of tourists to buy tickets and make their way down for a water tour. A line had formed at the booth, the sails not yet started. He shouldered his way to its head, then kept going. The attendant inside the booth called out. He ignored the command to stop and hustled down clammy stone steps that smelled of mold. A man waited at the bottom, most likely the tour boat's operator, who reacted to the unauthorized approach by holding up his hands, signaling halt. Cotton brought a knee into the man's gut, doubling him over. "Sorry about that," he muttered. He hopped into the boat, whose engine was idling, and released the two mooring lines. He gripped the throttle and shoved it forward, bringing the diesel's throaty chug-chug to life. The boat lurched forward, and he twisted the wheel, aiming the bow in the direction of the three amigos. He'd been on one of these before, having taken a couple of canal tours of Bruges. They usually tooled along at a snail's pace, seeing the sights, and he'd always wondered if there was more bark under the hood. And there was. He maxed out the throttle. The prop bit and the bow rose, cutting through the brown water of the narrow canal, tossing up white foam in its wake. He passed under the same footbridge, emerging on the other side where the canal dog-legged left and wound its way around a stretch of gray stone buildings, softened by clingy vines. Another sharp turn right and the waterway straightened, the stretch ahead flanked by more vine-covered houses and timber facades. He passed under the rusted scrolls of another arched bridge. The three amigos had a solid head start, but apparently were not using excessive speed, thinking they were finally in the clear. And that was allowing him to gain ground. The canal was about 50 feet wide, flanked on both sides by tall stone walls and leaning trees. Another of the tour boats suddenly appeared from the right at a junction. He veered left and passed close to the other boat's bow. Few of the other occupants escaped a bath from his wake. He waved an apology, but kept going, straightening out the wheel and focusing on where the route widened into a large basin at another T-junction. The three amigos were waiting in the basin, their boat perpendicular to his approach. Two of the men with guns aimed his way. They started firing. He was headed right toward the bullets, at nearly full throttle, the gap closing fast. He ducked below the windscreen and the rounds whined by. The amigo's boat jolted forward, blocking any turn to the left. The guns also kept firing. Too late to go right. Not enough room in the long rectangular basin to make the turn without hitting the barrier wall. No choice. He leaped into the water. The boat sped on, pilotless, but only for another 20 yards before slamming into the stone wall and exploding. He ducked beneath the surface, mindful of something he'd once read. Until the 1980s, raw sewage had been dumped into the canals. Hopefully 4 decades of cleansing had eliminated any hazards. He popped his head from the water. The three amigos were gone. Getting out of the canal could prove a problem. He saw no ladders or steps up along the walls that encased the waterway. He heard a siren and swiveled around. A police boat was racing his way, blue light flashing. His own boat was a burning hulk sinking into the canal. The police boat swung up alongside. 2 uniforms had their guns out and aimed. Neither looked friendly. Getting out of the water was no longer an issue. But where he would end up, that could be a big problem. Chapter 4 Jonty poured himself a generous splash of Krupnik. He'd always liked the drink, a unique combination of honey, herbs, and spices, diluted, boiled, then strained before being added to a vodka base. Legend said the recipe was created by Benedictine monks in Belarus and eventually traveled to Poland. Usually it was served warm, but he preferred his at room temperature. He sipped the concoction, the strong liquor soothing in a way that seemed to brush away any rough edges. He was still unnerved by the unpleasantness that had happened in the basement. The nosy spy was tied up and would stay there until Thursday. After that, they'd let him go. The information he'd learned was disturbing on a number of levels, and Vic was going to turn his attention to the matter. Reinhardt, of all people. Gandhi said it best, "There is a sufficiency in the world for man's need, but not for man's greed." That explained his arch-rival. He stared around at the old library. Sturney Castle seemed perfect, a 13th-century neo-Gothic fortification. It featured 3 wings situated around a pentagonal courtyard, enclosed on the 4th side by a stately main gate. It occupied strategic real estate, built into a rolling rock formation close to the river Orava, 50 kilometers south of the Polish border, safe within Slovakia. 5 towers, each crowned with a cupola, topped the corners, a balcony ringing the highest, conjuring images of a princess in peril. It had been able to resist the attacks of Turks, Cossacks, and Hussites who'd swept in regularly for centuries. It seemed a place that had never known poverty, as every room was chock-full of tapestries and antiques from its prosperous past. The Polish crown jewels had been hid here when the Swedes invaded in the 17th century. Then, in the 18th, the future king of Madagascar had been imprisoned here. Once owned by local aristocracy, It was taken over by the communists in the 1950s as part of a land reform policy. Thankfully, documents in the official registry were never changed, so after democracy was restored, the property was returned to its former owners, who proved incapable of maintaining it. Now it was a high-end rental, with a staff and caterers, available to corporations and individuals who could afford the hefty price tag. He walked over to the French doors and stepped out onto an upper terrace. Potted plants, full of color, lined the outer half walls. Birch, fir, pine, and spruce trees stretched as far as he could see through an ancient Jurassic valley. Northern Slovakia was spectacular. The Tatras, the highest range in the Carpathian Mountains, touched the northern sky, snow dusting the highest peaks, a mecca for hikers and skiers. Out of necessity, he lived a solitary life. He was philosophical about his failure with women, which seemed a recurring theme, and men did not interest him. Finding the hard to find, then making a sale, that he loved. And unlike Reinhardt, he preferred to manufacture his own business opportunities instead of preying off others. There'd been too many deals to count, each one profitable in its own way. He skirted the law for sure, but never had he been considered an official threat. He tried hard to stay apolitical, taking no sides, harboring no ideals. He was the embodiment of Switzerland, neutral in all that mattered, save for profit. He'd definitely come to enjoy the finer things of life, never having to worry about money, buying what he wanted, when he wanted, going wherever. Francis Bacon had been right. Money was a great servant, but a poor master. And now he was about to close the biggest deal of his life. A soft jangle signaled an incoming call. He found the phone in his pocket, today's cellular unit. He changed every 3 days, all part of an institutionalized paranoia and the embodiment of a maxim he'd long lived by. Nobody really needed to find him, unless he wanted to be found. "The Holy Blood was taken earlier," Vic said to him. "I have a confirmation email from the Russians." He smiled. Another RSVP. That made 5. Only the Americans and the Germans remained. "Any issues?" he asked. "It seemed to be a clean theft in Bruges." "Good to hear." "We need to make sure that nothing has been compromised," he told Vic. "I'm concerned about our guest in the basement and who sent him." They'd been extra careful leaving Bratislava, with the spy tied and gagged in the rear seat, ensuring that they were not followed and that their car had not been electronically tagged. "Be right on this, Vic," he said. "Reinhardt is way too close for my comfort." "I understand. I'll have more information shortly." "And what of this evening?" "It's all arranged. I'm headed north in a few hours." That was good to hear. He ended the call and returned inside, depositing his empty glass on the walnut sideboard. He'd chosen this locale for a variety of reasons. First, it was gorgeous. Second, it was within 2 hours of Krakow, but safely over the border in another sovereign state. Third, no one lived within 10 kilometers. And fourth, it came with lots of space. A ballroom with an upper gallery, dining hall, a dozen upstairs bedrooms, an ample kitchen, and, most important, servants' passages that offered a concealed way to move from one room to another. He loved secrecy. What a thrill to know things others did not. And here he knew something nobody else in the world knew. All others privy to the information were long dead. A fortuitous piece of knowledge that had dropped into his lap. Unimportant at first, beyond value now. Living by his wits had always intrigued him, as did the danger and glory that intrigue spawned, not to mention the rewards. But the clammy, tight band of fear that could sometimes encircle his gut like a snake? That he hated. Reinhardt. A problem. One he'd deal with, if necessary. But first, he had to destroy the president of Poland. Chapter 5. Warsaw, 6:30 p.m. President Janusz Tchaikovsky fled the palace and headed for a waiting car. He'd timed this excursion carefully, freeing his calendar for the rest of the day on the pretense of a rare evening off when he could have dinner and retire early. Consequently,
no coterie of self-important aides accompanied him.
No media. No one, other than his security detail. All agents of the Bureau Ochrony Rządu, the BOR, Government Protection Bureau. He'd been assigned two armed men and a nondescript Volvo for the off-the-books trip. The latest incarnation of the Republic of Poland came about in 1989. So, as far as countries went, this one was relatively young. There'd been a previous version, but World War II and the Soviet occupation interrupted its existence. Since its rebirth, there'd been 9 heads of state. The Constitution provided for a 5-year term with the possibility of a single re-election, but only one of his 8 predecessors had managed a second term. Polish politics, if nothing else, stayed fluid. Most of the everyday work was done by a prime minister, usually the head of the majority party in parliament. But in theory, it could be anyone. The national constitution provided the president with an executive veto, which could be overridden by a 3/5 majority in parliament. The president served as the supreme commander of the armed forces, able to order a general mobilization. He nominated and recalled ambassadors, pardoned criminals, and could override certain judicial verdicts. Pertinent to the current predicament, the president was also the supreme representative of the Polish state, with the power to ratify and revoke international agreements. Lucky him. He climbed into the car and they motored away from the palace, leaving through a side exit. His first term was drawing to a close. The qualifications for president were simple. Be a Polish citizen, at least 35 years old on the day of the first round of the election, and collect the signatures of 100,000 registered voters. The winner was chosen by an absolute majority. If no candidate achieved that threshold, a runoff was held between the top 2. He'd won his first term after a close runoff, and another battle loomed on the horizon, as various opponents were emerging. A former prime minister, a popular lawyer, 3 members of parliament, a punk rock musician who headed one of the more vocal minor political parties, a former government minister who'd declared he would run only if Tchaikovsky pissed him off. Apparently, that was now the case, as the loudmouth was gathering his 100,000 signatures. The coming political season looked to be a lively one. Thankfully, he was somewhat popular. The latest opinion polls showed a 55% approval rating. Not bad, but not overwhelming either. Which was another reason he now found himself in a car, watching the kilometers glide by, as he was driven west toward the village of Josefa. After 3 weeks of searching, the source of the problem had been found. A former communist-era loyalist who'd been dead for over a decade. It had been too much to hope that he took whatever he knew to the grave. Instead, some old information had surfaced, and not just random facts and figures. This was something that directly affected him. In fact, it could ruin him, especially with a hotly contested election on the horizon. Foolishly, he'd believed the past dead and gone. But now it seemed to be threatening everything. Time for him to deal with it face to face. The car passed through Josefa, perched on a cliff overlooking the river Wisła. It had a long history and an attractive old center, boasting a castle ruin and a cathedral, but its main claim to fame was a nearby refinery that employed hundreds. The house he sought was south of town, on a side road that led away from the river. His driver parked to one side, away from the street among the trees, where the car would not draw attention. He stepped out into the warm evening and walked toward the front door. A man waited, dressed in a black suit and black tie, with an inscrutable expression that was proper but cold. Michał Zima, the head of the BOR. He entered the house. A simple place, similar to the one in which he'd been raised in southern Poland, close to Rzeszów, his parents farmers, not revolutionaries. but that all changed in the 1980s. Private land ownership had never been allowed. To appease a growing unrest, everyone was promised ownership through purchase or inheritance. But it was all a lie. Eventually, his parents and most of the other farmers rebelled and refused to sell food at the undercut government set prices, instead donating their crops to strikers. A brave act that had made a difference. "Where is she?" he asked.
"Out back."
"And the other?" Jima motioned.
"In there."
"Tell me how you found this place."
"A bit of luck, actually. But sometimes that's all you have."
He caught the message. "Don't ask too many questions." His gaze raked the room and he noticed an array of framed pictures on a table. One caught his eye. He walked over and studied the image of a man dressed in a uniform, a major in the Polish army, with the insignia of the SB, the security service, on his shirt. He recognized the nondescript face, the razor-cut hair and manicured mustache. The same man from Mokotów prison. Alexei Dilecki. He'd neither seen nor heard anything of the man in decades. World War II destroyed Poland. Everything bombed and gutted to oblivion, with no resources and little manpower left to rebuild. The Soviets promised a rebirth, and many believed them. But by the late 1970s, the lies were evident, and the country's patience had come to an end. By then, everyone worked long hours, found little food in stores, and was constantly cold from a lack of coal and clothing, including coats. They were spied on all the time, fed propaganda, their children brainwashed. The threat of force never ended, nor had hunger, with the government even dictating how much a person could eat through ration cards. "We all have equal stomachs." That's what many had echoed. And when people were hungry, when their children were hungry, they would do anything to calm the pain. And they did. He liked what Orwell wrote. "All animals are equal, but some are more equal than others." That had been Alexei Dilecki. Politicians and police were always favored. They received more rations. They shopped at special stores. They lived in better housing with more privileges. They even had a name. Nomenklatura, a Soviet term for the list of government jobs always waiting to be filled. People were selected not on merit, but solely on loyalty to the regime. They became an informal ruling class unto themselves, the Red Bourgeoisie. Corruption and cruelty were constant means to their ends. And he was staring at one of the participants. He remembered what was said all those years ago in Mokotów prison. "Who knows? One day you might be a big somebody." He shook his head at the irony and liked the fact that Dilecki was dead. "Do you know him?" Jima asked. He'd only briefed one person on the relevant history, and it wasn't Jima. So he ignored the inquiry and said, "Show me what you found." And he replaced the photo on the table. He followed Jima into a small storage room, the space cluttered with remnants of a family's past. He saw the two rusted filing cabinets. "They're filled with documents," Jima said. "Reports, correspondence, memoranda. All from the late 1970s to 1990. Scattered dates and incidents. No real pattern to anything. Dilecki worked for the security service a long time. He would have been privy to many secrets. Apparently, he removed some of those when the communists fell." So much had been lost during that chaotic period after the Soviet Union collapsed and Poland re-emerged. Today, few cared about the past. Everyone was just glad it was over. The future seemed to be all that mattered. But such short-sightedness was a mistake, because history mattered. "Has anyone examined those files?" he asked. "Only me. And my review was quick and cursory, just enough to determine that it might be what you are looking for." He was curious. "How do you know I'm looking for anything?"
"I don't. I'm merely assuming, based on what I know so far."
He should inquire about the extent of what this man knew.
but not now. Have everything in those two cabinets loaded into the trunk of the car I came in. Zhima nodded his understanding. Did Deletsky's widow sell any of the documents, he asked. No, their son did. We have him in custody. That was new information. We arrested him a few hours ago. Zhima motioned and he followed him back to the parlor. A blue nylon duffel bag lay on the sofa. Zhima unzipped the top to reveal stacks of zlotys. $500,000. We recovered it from the son's house. Now it all began to make sense. The parents were good, loyal communists. The son, not so much. Decades had passed. The father was gone, the mother aging. Two file cabinets might hold the key to changing everything, especially when some of those documents mentioned the name Janusz Tchaikovsky. All you had to do was find a buyer. Has the son admitted to anything? Zhima nodded. He made a deal with a man named Vic DiGenti, who is a known associate of John D. Olivier. You say that name as if you know him. We do. He peddles information. Somewhat reliable, too. Our intelligence services have used him on occasion. The mother was totally unaware of what the son did. She only found out last evening, when he offered her some of the money. She was not happy. They had a bitter fight, just a few hours before we arrested him. Show me the rest, he said. Zhima led him out the back door to a small corrugated roof barn. Trees and shrubs shielded the structure from the nearby highway. Its door hung open, and he entered. A weak electric lantern dissolved the shadows. Not much there. A few tools, a wheelbarrow, an old rusted car, and a woman hanging from the rafters, her arms limp at her side, the neck angled over in death. She did it during the night, Zhima said, perhaps after learning of her son's arrest. Or maybe out of a sense of loyalty to her husband. We'll never know. She'd apparently climbed atop the old car, tied off a short length of rope, then stepped off to oblivion. He shook his head. Now everything depended on Belgium.
Chapter 6 Cotton sat in the cell, still damp from his canal swim. He really should take a shower, though this wasn't the Four Seasons. But as far as cells went, it wasn't so bad. Roomy, clean, with a toilet that worked. He'd been locked inside far worse.
So much for owing the Catholic Church one.
It was nearly 7 p.m. He'd been here alone for several hours. The Bruges police had not been in the best of moods when they fished him from the canal. They'd promptly cuffed his hands behind his back and tried to question him, but he knew when to keep his mouth shut. Of course, at some point he was going to have to explain things. Hopefully the priest from the basilica would tell them that he'd been the one to ask him to go after the reliquary. So far all they knew was that he'd stolen a boat and crashed it in the canal. By the time the cops arrived, the shooting had stopped and the three amigos were gone. He was the only problem. The police had taken his wallet. His passport was back at the hotel. They at least knew his full name, Harold Earl Malone. The nickname Cotton was nowhere on his Danish driver's license, or anything else official. People liked to ask where the label came from, and his answer was always the same. Long story. And it was. One that involved his father. He still recalled the day when he was 10 years old and the two naval officers came to the house and told him and his mother that his father's submarine had sunk, all hands lost. No body, no funeral. Everything classified. It took him nearly 4 decades to discover the truth, and the whole experience had bred an extreme distrust for government, no matter the level, which further explained why he hadn't spoken to anyone. When the time came, he hoped the truth would work best. After all, that was all he had to work with. Surely by now, the Bruges police knew of the theft. The Holy Blood was the most important object in the city. Hundreds of thousands came every year to see it. Since the 14th century, they'd paraded it around the town in huge annual celebration. But if they knew it was gone, why had they not come for a chat? Seems they'd want to know what he knew.
Or maybe not. A clang disturbed his thoughts. One of the metal doors down the hall opened, then closed. Footsteps echoed as they approached, a slow and steady clack. He looked up and spotted a woman. Petite, with a confident face and dark hair streaked by threads of silver. She was in her mid-60s, though he knew Justice Department personnel records, which he'd once seen, contained only N.A. in the space reserved for date of birth. Everybody was touchy about something. For her, it was age. Two presidents had tried to make her attorney general, but she'd turned down both offers. Why? Who knew? She tended to do what she wanted, which made her really good at what she did. He stood and approached the bars. Isn't this how we first met? Stephanie Nell smiled and nodded. In the Duval County Jail, as I recall. He grinned. I was a hotshot Navy lawyer who'd just shot a woman. Come on. She fired first, trying to kill me. And here we are, so many years later, and you've crashed a stolen boat into a canal. Trouble does seem to follow you. What about the three thieves and the reliquary they stole? That's the thing, Cotton. There's no theft. The revelation surprised him. Then he realized. You put a lid on it. She nodded. I was in Brussels at our embassy when the call came from the police. They learned you were once one of ours and made inquiries through Atlanta. The office contacted me. I, of course, had no idea you were here. But I claimed you nonetheless. He shrugged. Wrong place, right time. I just happened to be there. But those thieves knew exactly what they were doing. The whole thing was planned. Tell me more. He explained what had happened in the Basilica and after. She on one side of the bars, he on the other. When he finished, he asked, "What are you doing in Brussels?" The answer to that question will cost you. He understood. She'd left him in the cell for this conversation for a reason. A few years ago, when he'd retired early from the Justice Department, he'd thought seeing Stephanie Nell again would be a rarity. One of the reasons he'd quit was to escape the risks and try his hand at something different. He'd been a committed bibliophile all his life. Now the owner of his own shop in Copenhagen, his primary profession was books. He'd come to Belgium on the hunt for some rare tomes a few of his regular customers had expressed an interest in owning, an 1897 printing of Dracula, a 1937 first edition of The Hobbit, and a 1900 original of The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. All expensive and hard to find. He'd made a name for himself as a guy who could locate what collectors wanted. But instead of being at the book fair, he was in jail, his former boss apparently holding the key to the door. "What do you want?" he asked. "I always liked your directness. It saves a lot of time." While Danny Daniels had served as president, the Magellan Billet had been the White House's go-to agency. Stephanie had not always enjoyed such a chummy relationship with the executive branch. In fact, most presidents hadn't really cared for her. She and Daniels had not gotten along at first either, but she'd earned his trust. Daniels's two terms had ended, and he was now the junior U.S. senator from Tennessee. Divorced, he had cultivated a personal relationship with Stephanie that, if the rumor mill was to be believed, had blossomed into love. He was glad for her. She deserved happiness. Work should not be what defined a life. Or at least that's what he kept telling himself. Stephanie was one of a handful of people in the world whom he called a friend, one of his closest. They'd been through a lot together. His entire professional career as an intelligence agent had happened thanks to her. She took a chance on a young Navy lawyer and gave him the opportunity to become really good at what he did. So much so that she kept coming back to him for help, even in retirement. "You haven't answered my question," he said, "nor have you offered to get me out of here. I'm assuming the two are related, so let's cut to the chase. How much are you offering?" "Can this one be a favor?" Now it was his turn to toss her a quizzical look. "I have bills to pay. I'm here to buy books for people who were paying me to do it. A lot of money, I might add. I do have a business." "$100,000, she said. "How long?" "A few days. to Thursday evening at the latest. The threat level. This one could be tricky. Stephanie was not noted for exaggeration or underestimation, so if she attached the adjective tricky, that warning could not go unheeded. But as he'd learned through the years, sure things hid the most danger. Tricky might be better. 150, he said. A little extra for the tricky part. She nodded. Okay. I have big problems. Get me out of here, and I'll help you solve them. Chapter 7 Cotton followed Stephanie as they left the jail and stepped back onto the streets of Bruges. A flood of tourists was out enjoying the beautiful evening. The police had not been happy to see him go, but no one challenged Stephanie. Her authority came straight from Brussels, far higher on the food chain than any local police chief. Though his clothes had begun to dry from the dunking, his sandy blonde hair was still a mess. It was coming down off the high that action always gave him. He told himself over and over that he didn't miss it. But that was a lie. He seemed at his best when the pressure was on, though his attempt to catch the three amigos had not been one of his finest moments. Stephanie's sudden appearance, however, had placed a new light on things. Something big was happening. And who didn't like being a part of that? They made their way into the crowded central square. Bruges began as a 9th-century fortress, built to defend the coast from Vikings. Back then, the town faced the sea. But slowly, over the centuries, the ocean withdrew and the remaining mudflats evolved into dry, fertile soil, transforming the town into a major medieval trading hub. People had gathered in its cobbled main square since the 10th century, and standing there now, he envisioned fishermen selling their wares, farmers hawking produce, Flemish cloth being inspected by foreign buyers, and the many fairs and festivals that drew crowds from all over Europe. This was the New York City of its time, the center of social, political, and economic life for the entire province. He stared at the square. Most of it, he knew, came from a 1990s renovation that retained the feel of a bygone era while making it more pedestrian-friendly. No billboards, neon, or high-rises existed then or now. Its charm oozed from an unpretentious simplicity, the aging hand of time dominating with not a hint of neglect. The rows of step-gabled houses were full of hotels, banks, souvenir shops, retailers, bars, and cafes, everything put to good use as though it were not a priceless relic from another epoch. The trademark belfry cut a path high into the evening sky, nearly 300 feet tall and, as he'd found out a few years ago, worth a climb. On a clear day, the Flemish coast could be seen miles in the distance. "I'm listening," he finally said to Stephanie, who'd been quiet on the walk. Time for her to ante up. "Washington's in upheaval," she said. He smiled. What else is new? Every day there were press reports on the Warner Fox administration, detailing one misstep after another. Policy shifts and staff changes occurred constantly, all with little to no consistency. Fox would say one thing, his advisors and cabinet officers another. Everything seemed rudderless, adrift, lacking direction, hit or miss. Mostly miss. "How bad is it?" he asked. "They're idiots. They have no clue what they're doing. A band of arrogant, stupid imbeciles who managed somehow to get a grip on power." He chuckled. "Tell me how you really feel." "The Attorney General has never been inside a courtroom, never served in public office. He was a Wall Street corporate lawyer who graduated from Yale 145th out of a class of 152. His only saving grace is that the guy at number 133 in that same class was Warner Fox. They were roommates in law school. He's absolutely loyal to Fox, never questions anything. He just does what he's told." "Are you still being frozen out?" He'd been there on Inauguration Day, seen the early ineptness for himself. But Fox had been conciliatory, promising to be more open-minded and agreeing to keep Stephanie on as head of the Magellan Billet, though the new president had initially tried hard to eliminate both her and the agency. She shook her head. "Even our successes have been met with skepticism. My budget has been hacked by a third, which has handicapped what I can effectively accomplish. But that's the whole idea. They want me gone. He got it. But they're afraid of Senator Danny Daniels. He's a force to be reckoned with. A bad enemy to have, but a good ally. And boyfriend? She smiled. That too. He makes you happy. Every day. That's good to hear. And he meant it. Stephanie had lived a solitary life. Her husband died long ago, and her son lived in France fairly inaccessibly. He knew of no close personal relationships until Danny came along. Cotton firmly believed there was somebody for everybody. His own life seemed proof of that. He'd been divorced from his first wife for a number of years and thought love something of the past. Then Cassiopeia Vitt came along and changed everything. "How is Cassiopeia?" she asked, seemingly reading his mind. "Feisty, like always. She's coming to Copenhagen this weekend." "So you need to be done by Friday?" "Something like that." People filled the square, out for an early dinner or finishing off a day of sightseeing and shopping. He scanned the faces and tried to assess threats, but there were simply too many to know anything for sure. This wasn't like inside the cathedral, where things had been more contained, the people easier to compare and contrast. "Something strategic is occurring," she said. "What you saw in the basilica is not the first theft of a holy relic." He waited for more. "There have been four others." "Interesting." "All have been kept secret," she said. "For the record, I didn't agree with that tactic, but chalk it up to the all-knowing Fox administration, which stepped in and imposed that strategy." "Did other locations with relics at least beef up security?" She shook her head. "None were advised. The know-it-alls decided it would only attract more attention." "Obviously not a smart decision, given what happened today. There's been a lot of those made lately in Washington." He could see she was frustrated, which was not normal. This woman was usually a model of self-control, direct, pragmatic, truthful to the point of pain, honest to the point of nuisance. She almost never lost her cool, and there wasn't a political bone in her body, which could be both an asset and a liability. "What's going on here?" he asked. "What do you know about the Arma Christi?" Chapter 8. Jonty entered the castle's dining hall and sat at the stout table. The room stretched in a long rectangle, facing west and the vanishing sun. The table was an oak monstrosity that could accommodate at least 20 people. He loved the ornately framed, brilliantly colored paintings that adorned the walls. Lots of warriors, holding swords and spears, fighting epic battles. The rich colors conveyed strength, the free and forceful sweep of the brush illustrating a sense of exuberance. Sadly, no one was joining him for dinner. Nothing was more pleasurable than sharing conversation during a meal. But he had to maintain a low profile until the weekend, and part of that involved eating alone. The chef had prepared a lovely dish of roasted pork and boiled red potatoes, much more Polish than Slovakian. But here, so near the border, the cultures mixed. The damn communists had nearly destroyed Eastern European cuisine. What a horrible time. Everything had been rationed. Waiting in long lines became a way of life, hoarding an art form. No one ever knew when food would be available, or if anyone would be allowed to buy it. Restaurants were issued compulsory menus that never changed, and deviations were not allowed. Government cooking manuals specified the exact amount and number of ingredients for each dish. Needless to say, creativity was stifled. Thank goodness things had changed. He sat and spread a black linen napkin into his lap. A glass of red wine had already been poured. With the right prompts, food and drink being two of those, people would tell a stranger nearly everything. Nothing seemed sacred anymore. Facebook, Twitter, and every other social media site seemed proof positive of that. What no one would have ever yelled from their front porch to neighbors across the street was now posted for billions to see for all eternity. Still, He loved the internet. So much could be learned so fast with little effort and no fingerprints. He ate his pork, which had been cooked to perfection. He'd already supplied the staff with the hors d'oeuvre menu for Thursday, an elaborate international array of sweet and savory, all fitting for the guests who had come from around the world. He'd also bought an expensive variety of liquor, wine, and champagne, anything and everything the guests might enjoy. Food and drink went a long way toward enhancing a deal, as did ambiance, which was another reason he'd selected this olden fortress in the woods of northern Slovakia. Everything about it reeked of resolution. He finished the entree and hoped there was more. Being a man of the world, he'd made a point of becoming familiar with the finer things. Sadly, the ones he favored most carried a wealth of calories, which all seemed to go straight to his ever-expanding girth. Weight had become a problem of late. His tailor had been kept busy altering his many suits. He was far too heavy for his height, all thanks to a horrible diet and a hatred for exercise. Physically, he'd never been all that much. Flaccid, fleshy lips, a wide nose, and the bright eyes of a man who lived by guile, not brawn. His hair was cut simply and parted in the middle, squared off to either side of his perpendicular temples and whitening prematurely. He was beginning to show his 53 years. He'd lived an interesting life. His childhood was steeped in poverty. His mother, God rest her soul, cried a lot, so much that he began to believe that he was the reason. She also constantly talked about dying or leaving. He always wondered if she'd be there when he came home from school. Eventually, maturity taught him that she'd used all that as a means of control over him, his brother and his father, and the tactic affected him. If his own mother didn't care for him, why care about anyone else? If she'd leave, anyone would. So his relationships, whether business or personal, had all been superficial, mainly his fault, as he preferred to remain obtuse and uninvolved. Life, though, had definitely treated him as a favored son, the future an inviting, well-paved highway of opportunity. He liked to think of himself as noble in bearing, virtuous in character, cultured, sophisticated, and charming. But that was all part of the wall of bluff he'd built around himself. He'd grown to love the romance of being hunted, then becoming the hunter. He'd long ago dismissed